Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend, one of our strongest voices for peace and against war, Anne Wright. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent, more peaceful world. So let's begin with a little prayer, as we always do here. So I invite you, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and to relax and to recenter yourself. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace, who loves you personally and infinitely and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the nonviolent Jesus here with us and ask for whatever graces we need to do God's will and become the peacemakers we were created to be. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will and to do our part to help end war and poverty, racism, greed, injustice, fascism, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy peacemakers and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name we pray. Well, friends, it's a great blessing to welcome today my friend Anne Wright to speak with us about her life of working to end war and to promote peace and disarmament. Anne Wright is a retired U.S. Army colonel who worked in the military for 29 years, 13 on active duty and 16 in the Army Reserves, as well as a retired U.S. State Department official. She was a diplomat for 16 years and served in U.S. embassies such as Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Sierra Leone, Micronesia, Mongolia, and including Afghanistan. In 1997, Anne was awarded the State Department Award for Heroism after helping to evacuate several thousand people during the Civil War in Sierra Leone. Now, Anne achieved a lot of notoriety in March 2003, just when George W. Bush started the massive bombing war on Iraq. She was one of three State Department officials to publicly resign in protest of the U.S. war in Iraq. Since then, she has become a full-time activist working to end war, often working with organizations that I'm involved with too, such as Veterans for Peace, Code Pink, the International Peace Bureau, World Beyond War, No to NATO, and Women Cross DMZ, many other groups. She regularly travels to places the U.S. government does not want U.S. citizens to go, such as Iran, North Korea, Yemen, Afghanistan, Nicaragua. She's about to leave for Cuba, and she's often going there to study the effects of U.S. policies and the effects of our wars. She's been a coordinator, in particular, with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla for 16 years and has been jailed in Israeli prisons twice. She travels and speaks widely on war and peace, especially Palestine and the Israeli genocide in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. She's coming to us from Hawaii, where she lives, and is the co-author of the book Dissent, Voices of Conscience, and many other articles. Please check out her website, which is voicesofconscience.com. Anne Wright, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. Well, I was just trying to recall, you know, knowing you, and we've been together all around the world several times, including places like Cairo during the Gaza Freedom March, Kabul, Afghanistan together. You came out to Los Alamos at one of our protests, at least one, maybe more. But we've been at a lot of other demonstrations at the White House and I think the United Nations. Your journey is remarkable. from being in the military and then being a career diplomat, even in the embassy at Afghanistan, toward resigning and then becoming a full-time activist and advocate for peace in March 2003. I really want to get into your activism, but can you tell me something about that journey, and especially why you resigned and so publicly, and how is it that you did, and how come thousands of others aren't? You know, what happened?
Well, John, thank you very much. And, you know, it was quite a journey. I spent most of my adult life in the U.S. government. I joined the military, as many young people do, to get away from something. And I was getting away from the state of Arkansas, where I grew up. I wanted to go see the world. And back in the 60s, the jobs for women, you know, were very honorable, school teachers, secretaries, homemakers, but I wanted to get moving out of Arkansas. So when the Army recruiter came through, like so many other young people, join the Army, see the world, and that's what I wanted to do. And I was very lucky that I had good leadership. I was not sexually assaulted. I was certainly harassed as a woman, because less than 1% of the people in the military at the time were women. Now it's up to 17%. But right now, it's always been difficult, but under the current administration and Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense, they're really going after the role of women in the military. All that to say, then I joined the State Department and became a U.S. diplomat in all those places that you said. And it was finally when the Bush administration deciding to invade and occupy Iraq with no real evidence at all of weapons of mass destruction, I and two others actually, decided that we would resign. And why more people didn't? Well, it's part of the realities of life, that you've got kids in college, you've got mortgages, you've got the need for a steady income. And just like right now, for the genocide in Gaza, we've only had 14 people from the federal government that have resigned. However, now with the massive slicing and burning of the federal government, there are plenty of people, I think, who probably in their moral compass knew they should be resigning. Well, they're kicked out of the government anyway. So I hope, because of the slashing and burning, and I hope they're out on the streets to use their conscience for saying to this administration no to all of the crazy things that are happening right now, including immigration detentions and killings because of witnessing abuses that ICE and other federal agents are doing, much less an invasion of Venezuela to kidnap the leader of Venezuela, the attacks on Iran, and apparently the need for us to invade and occupy Greenland. So if that isn't enough for people to get busy and get out on the streets, I don't know what is.
Hey, Anne, thank you. So what a journey then. Now, to the friends listening, Anne travels around the world into war zones more than anybody I know, and is just, if she's not around the world, she's on the street somewhere. I know this because I keep running into her and I hear reports of sightings. She's like the risen Jesus in the underground movement, popping up here and there. So in other words, to the listeners, there's so much to talk about with Anne. What I propose is going through several countries because it's not chronological with Anne. So Anne, I'd like to ask you a little bit about Iraq and then Afghanistan. Then we'll talk about Palestine and so forth. Okay? So you stepped down in March 2003 when this horrific bombing war in Iraq begins. Tell me about all your experience and what you did to try to stop the war in Iraq.
Well, I was I was the deputy ambassador in Mongolia when the lead up to the war in Iraq was going on. I had just come from being in Afghanistan, helping reopen the embassy there. But I was in Mongolia, and here was all this hype about weapons of mass destruction. We needed to go in and take them out, take Saddam Hussein out, and it was like, you know, it just didn't meet the smell test, because I, over the years, you know, from the 1990s, we had been hearing from the UN inspectors, many of whom were U.S. and intelligence persons who were on the UN team looking for weapons of mass destruction. And those members of that team said the weapons of mass destruction Iraq had have already been destroyed. There are none. And finally, it was like, well, they're just lying through their teeth again. And I'd been in the government, you know, for almost 35 years at that point between the Army and the State Department. And it's like, you know, I've had enough. I am not going to go along with this next thing that an administration is cooking up. By that time, that was the eighth presidential administration that I had been in and held my nose to plenty of policies, but never resigned. So this one, it was like, well, I just decided I was going to resign. And whether or not my resignation got any publicity, who, you know, we didn't know. That wasn't why I was resigning. It was on my own morality and my own conscience that I just could not be a part of what I knew was going to be a horrific, horrific death of so many people in Iraq. So that's what in a cold, cold morning in the winter of Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, I finally finished what they said later was the longest letter of resignation that the State Department had ever had. And that was 3.5 pages. So I let them have it for all the other things I was concerned about, too.
And then did you ever go to Iraq on a peace mission?
Nope, I never did. I never joined so many peace people who were there during the actual shock and awe, like Kathy Kelly and, right, you know, all the people that had spent years since Gulf War One, and mm-hmm. then the attack, Kathy and so many others had gone to Iraq.
Yeah.
But I just had a feeling in my stomach that that was one place, because I had resigned over it, that I felt that might be the end. If I went there, I'd be a target, and I wanted to live my life to do some other things too.
Good. You're reminding me, I went to Iraq in the 90s with some Nobel Peace Prize winners, and it was so clear that this was way before 2003. There were no weapons of mass destruction. But when that war started, I'm living in New Mexico, and we have Los Alamos in our backyard, and that's when we were starting the campaign there. And our main message for years was, President George W. Bush, there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, so stop the war. Don't bomb them. But we found them. They're here in New Mexico. Don't bomb yes. us. Just come and get rid of them. And then we would issue just outrageous statements that would get tons of publicity. Well, then the Afghanistan war, and you had actually helped reopen the embassy. Tell us about your experiences in solidarity with the people, the suffering people of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I volunteered to go to Afghanistan to help reopen an embassy that had been closed for 12 years. And one of the reasons I wanted to go is that, well, first, I'd had experiences in opening and closing embassies. That happened in Sierra Leone. We had to close an embassy because of a civil war. And then we reopened it 8 months later. So I'd had that experience. Plus, I'd been in the military, and I know that that we had a large number of military people that were starting to move into Afghanistan following the massive CIA presence that was there. The CIA really went in first with its own Air Force and brought in lots of paramilitary CIA, and then U.S. Special Forces came. And I wanted to see what was happening, because it seemed to me like after 9/11 that we were going after the leadership of Al-Qaeda. But why in the world were we starting to put military in? Because it sure seemed to me like it was like a police, a law enforcement, that sort of operation, rather than invading a whole country over this thing. So I wanted to go to see what was happening. And I ended up being there for almost 2 months, and before they started bringing in people who are going to be more of the permanent staff of the embassy. But during that 2-month period, I got to travel around quite a bit of the country because the Taliban had started laying low. Some of the leadership had headed to the hills with the Al-Qaeda group, but most of them just buried their weapons and just hung out at home and didn't really take pot shots at the U.S. forces until quite a bit later. So we could travel throughout most of Afghanistan in those early days. And it was, getting to meet the people throughout the country, getting to meet the senior leadership of the new civilian government that was coming in. And all of these people, all they wanted was a little peace. After this, the Soviets were there for 10 years, then the Taliban took over, and then here comes the U.S., and it's like, please, can't you all just leave us alone and let us have some time for peace for ourselves? And that didn't quite happen that way. I did go back several times after I resigned from the government. I went back to meet with organizations in Kabul primarily. And at that time, the hope was that even though the U.S. was in there massively, that indeed the structures of government would become very, very strong, and the U.S. could leave much sooner than the 20 years that it did, that it would get out, and that the civilian structures of Afghanistan would be able to begin really the leadership for that country. Well, it didn't turn out that way. With the Trump administration negotiating with the Taliban for the removal of U.S. troops in Trump 1, and then Biden and his gang implementing a departure that was a very bad way to end the U.S. there, that the structures that should have been in place were definitely not. And the people of Afghanistan now are suffering again under the very, very restrictive government of the Taliban.
I remember when we were there together, and I don't even remember the year, maybe 2014, with our friends Mairead McGuire, the prestigious Nobel laureate, and Shane Claiborne. We were mainly with youth. And most of that week, as I recall, Anne, and I wanted to see if you'd share any thoughts on this, we heard testimonies from these poor kids in Kabul who told about how their families out in the country, might be gathered around the fire one night, and a drone, U.S. drone would fly at 30,000 feet over them and drop a bomb and kill everybody in the village, and the kids survived. And so this just went on all day for a couple of days. And I learned so much about the horrors of the U.S. drone warfare, which was really full on in Afghanistan and maybe one of the future things of war. Do you have any thoughts or recollections or stories about all of that?
Well, yes. And, particularly the youth that came from the outer parts of the country and then had come into Kabul to try to get out of all of the drone warfare that was going on not only in Afghanistan but on the border with Pakistan. The U.S. Was already well deep into the drone warfare in Iraq, and they had started it in Yemen. So it was heartbreaking to, and in fact we several of us had gone not only to Afghanistan, but we went to Pakistan on an assassin drone time to talk to people in Afghanistan up along the border of what was happening there. And then we took another trip, and that was to Yemen to talk with people from Yemen about what the U.S. assassin drone program was doing to them in their country. So we've been all over the place as the U.S. continues to use these drones. And as we're seeing right now, it's the drone warfare on boats in the Caribbean, supposedly going after drug runners, but no evidence being presented to anyone that that's what is on the boats that they're blowing up. But they're using the drones there And they're going back into Afghanistan and blowing people up again in Afghanistan with these assassin drones.
You know, Ann, remember that front page New York Times report that on Tuesday mornings, first thing, Obama would come down to his office, have his coffee after sending the kids off to school, and review the assassination list and approve the top 30 or 50 assassinations for that week. This went on the whole time he was president. And there you and I were over in Kabul, and these kids would be sobbing, saying, I don't even know what the Taliban looks like. That's one of them. Remember one of them. And you're telling me that there's a plane 30,000 feet above, like, the Hindu Kush Mountains, which is like the Himalayas, and there's no human being on this plane. It's full of gasoline, bombs, and cameras. And some kid in Las Vegas, said, like literally a teenager at the Creech Air Force Base, is looking at the video and deciding that that light from that fire in that village up in the mountains must be Taliban, and they blow everybody up. And nobody's the Taliban there. But nobody has uniforms. And, you know, you just go, what have we become, Ann, you know?
Well, indeed, when the president of the United States was doing exactly what you were saying, that every week he was identifying people by name that those drones were going to go after. It just, for the good that he did, he sure did a lot of bad, too. And this identification of people to be assassinated, I mean, it's just like Trump, who assassinated the top general in Iran during his first time in power, and now doing the assassinations of these people that are in these boats in the Caribbean. I will mention that there are opportunities in the U.S. for people to protest against these assassin drones. We still have times now in Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico, part of your old stomping grounds. We are now doing protests out there because that has turned into being another training hub for the U.S. military, for the pilots of drones, as well as Creech Drone Base. So
outside
if people
Las
want
Vegas,
to, outside Las Vegas, there is an opportunity for people to come out and help us challenge the U.S. assassin drone program.
So I want to talk now, Ann, about Israel, Palestine, West Bank, and Gaza. So tell me about your trips and your thoughts about that, and then we'll talk about the flotilla, okay?
Mm-hmm. Well, I first went to Gaza in 2009.
Our trip, the Gaza?
That was early in January of 2009, and then the Gaza Freedom March was in December of 2009. And the 12 months between those two, I went back to Gaza 5 different times, taking groups of people with Code Pink Women for Peace, and we brought groups of 50 people in to see the level of destruction that the Israelis had caused with their Operation Cast Lead that happened in December of 2008 and January of 2009. And it was just the reason that Medea Benjamin and I went in the very beginning was that we saw the level of destruction. We were actually at Fort Benning going to the School of the Americas Watch when the Israelis were attacking Gaza, and we watched on TV and saw this destruction. It was like, holy smoke, this is unbelievable. It's like World War II. So we went, but we weren't the first internationals to get in there. Kathy Kelly actually went the week before we did, and then all of us were trying to get as many pictures, talk to as many people, and come back to rally people in the United States and other places to go to Gaza, see with your own eyes, and then go after the Israeli government for what they're doing to Gaza. So five trips later, then we decided, well, let's bring lots of people to Cairo and then arrange for them to go into Gaza for only 24 hours as a commemoration for that year that the Israelis had bombed Gaza. But we were foiled by the Egyptian government, who did not let anyone but actually one busload of people go into Gaza. So the rest of the 1,500 people were in Cairo. And I think at the end of the week, the Egyptians wished they'd let all of us go into Gaza, because people were having hunger strikes all over Cairo. They were climbing the pyramids with big Palestine flags. They were at every one of the embassies with a banner saying, stop killing in Gaza, stop your complicity. So it really was a momentous time. And it was kind of 1.5 years before the Arab Spring hit, and Tahrir Square became well known throughout the world for the square of attempting to have freedom in Egypt. But it didn't quite work out that way. And now they're under, you know, another severe dictatorship.
I was on that trip with Anne to the listeners, and it's hard to describe. There were 4,500 people from around the world. We were all going to go into Gaza, which is a long trip, and then Mubarak prevented it. And then I was one of the 50. Mubarak announced that I and a few others, like David Hartz, would be allowed into Gaza. But the last minute, about half of us, Anne, decided not to, because we were getting direct messages from Gaza, don't come. You got to be in solidarity with everybody. And some of our friends, Anne, violated that request and went ahead, and there was just 25 or 30. I kind of still wonder today whether I should have done that, because I've never been allowed in Gaza. Anyway,
yeah.
Incredible time. And then was it then that you started the flotillas, or you kept going to Palestine after that?
Well, the first groups that actually tried to send boats into Gaza and were actually the only ones who've ever been successful started in 2008, and it was called the Free Gaza Movement, and they've sailed five small little boats over a two-year period into Gaza, and for whatever reason, the Israelis let them in. And then, after Cass led, it was like, well, we've got to buck this thing up. We've got to get some more boats. So that was when the Mavi Marmara, the large ship from Turkey, plus seven other ships, in 2010, I had a real flotilla, a large number of boats going at the same time toward Gaza. And that's when the Israeli commandos came down on the Mavi Marmara, killed people, 10 people on the boat, wounded 50. I had left that boat 10 hours before the attack happened and went on to a smaller boat called Challenger 1. The Israelis came onto all seven of the boats, beat people up, but it was on the Mavi Marmara that they killed people. So that was the beginning of the flotillas. And then in 2011, we had 10 ships that were ready to sail from Greece. And then the Israeli government paid off the Greek government to keep our boats in Greece through administrative things. Although our U.S. boat tried to escape one day, and we were stopped about 3 miles outside the port of Piraeus with a Greek Coast Guard boat with commandos on it that looked a lot like the Israeli commandos. And we were stopped, but we did make a break for it. But from there, in the successive years, we've now sailed over 35 ships until 2025. And then in 2025, we sailed the Madeleine ship, which had Greta Thunberg on it, only 12 people on that boat. Then the Handala that had 22 people on it. And then here came the friends who had been on various ones of our boats, helped organize what's called the Global Samud Flotilla. And they were able to get donations to the extent that they had 42 boats that set sail from Barcelona, then went through Tunis, then to Sicily, then off Crete, and then finally headed toward Gaza in a 30-day sail with over 600 people.
Wow.
Then we had another boat called the Conscience, which had earlier been bombed in Malta when we were about ready to put 50 people on board that boat. It got bombed the night before, and I mean really bombed. The whole bow of the boat was just blown up. And then we had it taken back to Turkey and had it repaired. And we sailed the Conscience with 92 people on board and then seven other small sailboats that had another 40 or so people.
This was last year, 2025?
This was in 2025.
During the killings?
The genocide.
It was all during that time. And you got materials into Gaza?
Nope.
No, nothing went in.
None of the boats have gotten in. And despite the Israelis always saying, oh, if you'll just kind of give up, we'll make sure whatever it is that you're carrying, whether it's medical supplies, whether it's construction materials, we'll make sure they get in. Well, of course, that will never happen.
Everybody last year who was trying, they would be arrested. So the Israelis would come and storm the boats and take everybody away to jail.
They stormed all the boats and mm-hmm. took them to Israeli prison and treated them not as bad, but in the same manner that they treat Palestinians, which is pretty brutal. And we had people that were beaten up, that were sexually assaulted, that went on hunger strikes and then were beaten up for being on a hunger strike. Many of them came back with intestinal problems because of the dirty water, the bad food, which is all, and it's nothing more. I mean, the Palestinians get that in all the time, and they're in there for months, if not years at a time. So our folks got a little taste of what the Palestinians get every single day.
Wow. You know, Anne, I'm not changing the subject. You can reflect however you want, but I don't know that people realize that in the year 2025, last year, the Trump administration in my county bombed 9 places. And I'll list them: Syria, Venezuela, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Nigeria. But see, I include Gaza, Palestine, and I include Sudan because that war has been going on forever. We sell weapons to all sides. Tell me your thoughts or activities or suggestions about how we can oppose these wars and what you've been doing about them. I mean, because there's so many countries and it's going to continue.
Well, certainly we have to, as you have just mentioned, all these countries. And here we have a president that says he's the peace president. He wants the Nobel Peace Prize and he's bombing all these countries.
More than any year in U.S. history. We never had 9 countries bombed in U.S. history.
And then he just renamed the U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington, D.C., which actually was not much of an institute for peace. Carried on a lot of the whatever administration was in power. They kind of parroted what that administration had. But Trump has now named the U.S. Peace Institute the Donald J. Trump Peace Institute. So, you know, using all of these things out on the streets, making sure you write your congressmen and women every day before breakfast with one more thing that they can add to the list of things they ought to be contacting the White House about, and to mobilize your own community to, you know, to stand up to say we strongly oppose what's going on, and then we've got to figure out how to make this opposition really hurt in terms of nonviolent hurting, hurt the administration to make them stop this stuff.
Can you say a word about, on the top of all of that, nuclear weapons and your efforts to stop, abolish nuclear weapons?
Oh, my God. You know, and having the fingertip of a guy that is the war president, again, another one of them, you know, continuing what the Biden administration had done. Well, and starting with the Obama administration, this renovation of all of our nuclear weapons, that has caused at least 3 new industrial plants to be built to modernize our nuclear weapons, of which 1 or 2 of them can cause a nuclear war that will eliminate us from the face of the earth. So I, along with, you know, tons and tons and tons of people, do what we can to try to bring the information to the American public. And in fact, there have been some new books that have come out that are really scary. The Nuclear War, Ann Jacobson, I think is her name. That's a wild one. The House of Dynamite, which is on Netflix, actually done by a person that's very pro-war. She's done a lot of various administrations, lauding of the U.S. military. But the House of Dynamite does give you a pretty good view of what would happen if we start having nuclear exchanges. This last year, I was invited to go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki as a part of the international conferences on the abolition of nuclear weapons, and speaking at the very large conferences that they have in both of those Japanese cities. I think we in the United States kind of, we We definitely are not aware of how much that the nuclear or the atomic explosions in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki are still part of the living memories of the people of Japan. And at each one of the conferences I went to, there were thousands and thousands of people that were attending the various sessions of it. We did have U.S. Prisoners of war that were in Japan that were killed by our own atomic weapons. We do have our own U.S. military folks who have been injured by the explosions, the testing that we did out in the Marshall Islands and other places. But bringing home to the U.S. public that we have in our arsenals, as do the Russians, the ability to blow this whole planet off out of the universe. I mean, it's just crazy how much stuff, how much nuclear power we have, that if any of the nuclear powers start one or two missiles, then it's all over for all of us, because nobody will know who's going to be going after whom next. And so I think they're just going to blow us up, and we don't want that.
So what suggestions do you have for us as ordinary peacemakers? And you've said a lot we can do already, but a few thoughts, but also your suggestions about how we can sustain ourselves. I think we need peacemakers who just don't give up. And you've been a model for me. You're just relentless and persistent. And that's really critical to peacemaking and nonviolence and what is needed now. That is to say, people working for the abolition of war who are in it for the long haul. But how do you sustain? What's your advice about sustaining yourself?
Well, I think for sustaining all of us, we have to make sure that we're around people who share the same views, that are so concerned about the future of humanity. We need people that we can talk to develop ideas, to see what we can do in our local communities. Where are the pressure points in our communities? Is it the churches? Do we need to talk more with the various denominations? Is it our local or a state level governments where we need to have at least a resolution saying no nuclear weapons? Is it writing, having campaigns for writing specific members of Congress? Is it having a peace demonstration or a peace walk? You know, right now we have, 20 Buddhist monks that are walking from Texas to Washington, D.C. They don't have signs. They don't have megaphones. They're just walking. And seeing the YouTubes along their course of the thousands, tens of thousands of average Americans who have taken the time to go out and observe, to be there in silence with these silent monks as they walk along. It's just amazing that that peace march is causing such a reaction in rural communities as they're walking through the southeast part of South Carolina, the northern part of Georgia. Hundreds of people going out on these rural roads that the monks are walking along. You know, it's incredible the things that we can do. You know, Veterans for Peace had a march for Gaza that went all the way from Maine to Washington, D.C. in 2024. And the same thing happened. There were people all along the way that came out. So never underestimate trying to get 5 people, 10 people, 20 people together to do something that will galvanize the rest of your community.
Well, our time is up, Anne. And so my last question would be, besides that, what you just said, do you have any other closing words of encouragement for our listeners about carrying on this great mission of justice and disarmament and nonviolence?
Well, I think the last message is it's our own conscience that we have to watch out for. And I think we all want to be able at the end of the day to say, I've done what I could on this particular day in some way to try to stop the violence in our world. And whether it's violence that's happening with ICE raids in our local communities, whether it's the violence our national government is wreaking on other people, that we can do something every single day. It may not be the most stellar thing. It may not be the thing that stops whatever it is, but we have to be consistent and we have to keep moving with this. So it's for our own good, our own psyche and our own mental health that we do this, as well as for trying to stop these issues that are dangerous to our world.
Well, thank you, Anne. Thank you so much for all you do and for speaking with me today. And friends, I invite you to check out Anne Wright's website. Again, it's voicesforconscience.com. And thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. And I hope you'll check out other podcasts and programs at beatitudecenter.org. Maybe make a donation to help support this free work. Also, please sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about upcoming episodes of the podcast and upcoming Zoom programs. And feel free to leave some positive feedback on the platform you use. But most of all, I ask everybody to tell your friends and colleagues about the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. Try to mention it to 5 or 10 people a week so that it can go viral. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus. See you next time.